Our story is about a man by the name of Yisachar Tzvi Rosemary. Came from the Rosenes family. They were exiled in the Spanish Inquisition. And the family lived in Poland in a town named Sosnowitz. Now, this is a story that I heard this past week, Thursday. I want to share with you because Friday, I think it's Zion Teves, is the yard side, is the year of Yisachar Tzvi Rubin's passing. And the story I heard from his own daughter, who also grew up in Sosnowitz, Mrs. Bella Rubin, and Mr. Rosmarin was a businessman. And he had a wife who ran the store downstairs, and he had eight children. And I just want to share with you a few short stories about his lifetime, because there is a concept which we will speak about in a minute that I think these stories personify. So the Germans were coming to power, and they made a declaration, what was called Ausjuden, where they said any Jew that was from Poland or from other countries had to leave Germany. And one day, Mr. Rosmarin is walking in the street, and he sees another Jew looking. So he asks him, what are you looking for? And the guy says, I'm looking for a place for my family. I was kicked out of Germany. He was about to do Yid. His name was Steinitz, and he had eight children. And no one wanted to take him in with eight children, and no one wanted to rent him a room when he had eight children with him. And Mr. Rosmarin said, I have a floor in my house, you come live by me. And just like that, he came back home with Mr. Steinitz, rented him the top floor of their house. And Mr. Steinitz asked him, you don't think this is going to be a burden? And he said, no, you have eight children, I have eight children, we match, perfect, come. You take the top floor, we live in the middle floor, and they rented out the bottom floor and the top floor. And when Mr. Steinitz offered to pay more rent, because he had more children living in that floor, so Mr. Rosmarin replied and said, what do you mean? You're going to pay the same rent as the guy on the other floor pays, and he stayed there. One of the midot that were fascinating about Mr. Rosmarin, he was also known as Jala, was that he wouldn't talk Lashon Hara. He didn't have time to speak badly about other people. And in the words of his own daughter, she said he was so focused on giving life and helping people that he didn't have time to be dealing with death and hurting other people with what he would say. And the story took an interesting turn when the Germans came to town. He had a son, Menyek, who was exceptionally smart when it came to all kinds of mechanics, and he figured out how you could take old batteries, take them apart, and make them back into new batteries, make them good again. And what they did was, in their bedroom, they started a factory for recycling batteries, for taking old batteries, making them good again. And when they saw the Germans were deporting their neighbors, so they hired children. And they told the Germans that being the batteries are so small, it requires the small hands of children in order to make these batteries. And the Germans bought it. And so they had 30 children. And the wealthy came to Mr. Rosmarin and said, we'll pay you this much, that much, take our children. And Mr. Rosmarin refused. He said, the first children that the Germans take are always the poor people's children. And so he insisted on taking the poor people's children to work there, and he saved tens of children's lives. There's a woman named Mrs. Goldina Diamond. I think she lives in Canada. And she is one of the people that remain who were saved because the Germans needed those batteries to the point where they afterwards brought them to another bigger place, and he had more children that he saved. Saved many, many children. And these children were last to be deported to Auschwitz, and that's why many of them survived. Four of his eight children were killed before his wife's eyes. He and his wife were in a bunker, and the Germans came and shot. And after the Holocaust, he used to say, don't ever speak bad about Hashem, because Hashem has done so much good for us, he used to tell his family. And he used to say, Hashem, you took half and you gave me half, and I am so lucky. That was his vantage point. That was his perspective. And after the Holocaust, so they were in a camp named Bergen-Belsen. And the young, the men and the women, started matching up and living together. And he found his wife, and he found some of his daughters. Later on, he found his son. And he and his wife was in charge of the soup kitchen. They would go to the young people that they knew, and they tell them, don't live together like non-Jews. In Judaism, we have a way of marriage, and we'll marry you off. And then his wife would sit up at night and take curtains that the Nazis left behind and sew them into dresses for the girls so that they could go down the aisle like challahs. And they'd walk them down as parents. And hundreds of people were married off by this couple. Now you'll ask me, was he a chief rabbi? Was he the most learned person in town? And the answer is no. He was a fine Jew. And I think that what these stories show us, and there are rabbis in Israel still alive today, there's Rav Hofkut, Hopskat, I forgot the name, the Rav, who was partner with them in marrying off these hundreds of young people. And it went to the point where after they got all the young people they knew in their surroundings married, there were 10,000 people in Bergen-Belsen, they did research, and any time they'd hear there was a young couple that was living together that had not been halachically wed, they would go and befriend them, and then they'd talk to their friends, and they'd influence them to have a kosher wedding. And you understand the impact of what happened at Bergen-Belsen, because if a person is just living with a girl and they never got married, so then they could be together for a week or a month or a year, and then there could be someone else. But if they got married, so then they probably had a very, very substantial hand in the continuation of the Jewish people, in the faithfulness of the couples to one another. And we look at this story, and there are more stories to tell. I could tell you more stories about him and his wife. And I think that this story personifies a concept that the Torah keeps on driving home to us. The Torah repeatedly tells us that we have a responsibility as a people. Other people have leaders, you know. So there's a Mother Teresa, very nice. I respect what she accomplished. We're not taking that away from her. But the Torah tells us that we have a responsibility to be Mamlechet Kohanim, a kingdom where we're all Kohanim, we're all priests, we're all servants of Hashem. We each have a responsibility to learn Torah, we each have a responsibility to know Torah, and we each have a responsibility to be a kingdom of tremendous people. And I think that when we hear these stories, that's one of the messages we have to take away from them. We have to realize that the stories are here to teach us how we ourselves are to behave. How we ourselves, in moments of challenge and in moments where other people could focus on what's bad and what they're missing, we can focus on what's good and what we have. And how can we help others with what we do have? I spoke to his daughter once and she told me a beautiful line. She lived in a small apartment. And when I visited her, she showed me that under this table, the table was covered with a big tablecloth, so he couldn't see under the table, and you'd look underneath and you'd see a bag, and here's this grandson's bag of clothing, so he could stop in whenever he needs to. He's stuck for the night, he could stay here. And back here, this one has his stuff, and that one has his toothbrush. And I said, how do you, in your small apartment, how do you fit so much for so many people? And she taught me a tremendous line. She said to me, the house you live in is as big as your heart is. That's the measurement of your house. It's not a question of meters. It's a question of your heart. If you have room in your heart, then you have room for everyone. If you don't have room in your heart, then it doesn't matter how big the house you live in is. You won't have room for people. The size, the dimensions are defined by the heart. I asked her. The conversation began because in the last half a year, I decided that I want to learn from the people who came out of the Holocaust religious. And I've been asking everyone I could meet who I have a close enough relationship with to ask the question. I've been asking all of them the same question. And I tell them I understand any person who came out of the Holocaust and stopped being religious. I can understand that. I wonder what gave people the strength to continue being religious after the Holocaust. That's my question. I want to understand what people view as the thing that gave them the strength to hold on. And she told me about her father, that the minute he was liberated, the first thing he was doing was looking for tefillin. And her mother, the second she was liberated, she went to the side and started davening and didn't stop till the day she died. She would go around, and we'll finish with this story. Her mother would go around in Florida to people's houses, old people like herself, old widows, and knock on their door before Shabbos and ask them if they had candles to light for Shabbos. She would purchase fish and prepare fish, and she would purchase small loaves of challah, and she'd come with a tray with two candles, loaves of challah, and fish. And she'd ask the people, "Do you light Shabbos candles?" And the people would say, "No, there's nothing to me. I'm not interested." And she would say, "I have a whole tray for you. Wouldn't you want to have challahs for Shabbos and fish? All you have to do is tell me you're going to light candles in honor of Shabbos, and I'll give you the whole package." And she had tens of old women. They called her the Rebbitzin. She had tens upon tens of old women in Florida that slowly started lighting candles. And you'd walk around in her neighborhood before she came in, and you'd see no candles in the windows. And after a short time that she was there, suddenly you saw house after house, apartment after apartment, people were lighting candles in honor of Shabbos. I could continue because I've taken the time to learn many stories about this fine couple, and I think that there's a lot that we could learn from them. But being that the Artzeit was just this past Friday, so I want to share with you a few stories which moved me more than other stories I heard, because again, these were people who lived b'toch ami anochi yeshevet, like the Navi says. They were a part of the Jewish people. He was not the rabbi of the community. He was not the leader of the community. He was a fine Jew. He had a fine role in the community. But we have to know that the Torah, again, is about each and every one of us being a Kohen. Yes, we have our Kohanim, but Hashem says to all of us that we are supposed to be a nation of Kohanim. And I think that in many ways, these people personified that. They are exemplary products of this idea of every person having the responsibility to be the Kohen.